I only know Ridley as the guy who was very famous for making Red Bull being super quick in the pit stops.
I mean, there was that. And then, like, if I'm not wrong, he was the one that lobbied for Michael Masi to, like, start the race one lap early. So,
not exactly the
best legacy, but interestingly enough.
Welcome to RacePod. Welcome back to another episode. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Jonathan.
And together we are co-hosts of RacePod, where we talk about all things Formula One.
RacePod is the extension of Race Recap, a LinkedIn newsletter created by two F1 fans where we discuss the world of Formula One. RacePod serves as an extension to that content pillar, where we will speak about various off-track events from the F1 grid, while also looking at other motorsports around the wider community.
Alright, so we're back with another episode on the eve. Not on the eve, actually. During the Singapore Grand Prix race weekend, there's been plenty of storylines that have cooked up throughout this weekend so far, but I think we'll be talking about that more in the next episode. I guess on my end, I think in this past month so far, throughout the leading up to the recording of this episode, I actually had the chance to check out F1 in Schools, which is the state finals that was held in Malaysia. It was a pretty cool experience. F1 in Schools, if you're not aware, for our listeners, it's basically a global STEM challenge where they gather a bunch of school kids together. They are basically trying to emulate what it's like to run a Formula One team, you know. So they gather a bunch of kids together. They create a car, obviously, right? So there's the car goes racing, but also the kids are judged based on a range of criteria, right? So how well they present themselves in front of the judges. So it's not just about the racing, but the racing is a big deal out of F1 in Schools. So the way it works is that there are like nationals and international stage, right? So the state finals, basically, there's going to be one champion from each state which go on to compete in the nationals F1 in Schools competition in Malaysia. And whoever wins that national competition will go on to compete on the international stage. Yeah, that was my weekend. Yeah.
I mean, we've spoken to some people who have gone to Formula Students, which would be the college and uni version of this, also on a larger scale, which, as far as I'm aware, is also judged on a range of criteria based on costing and various technical criteria of the cars itself. So would you say Formula One in Schools would probably be similar, but on a smaller scale that is manageable for school-going kids?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I think F1 in Schools is a much more toned-down scale as a Formula student. Obviously, for Formula students, they design like an actual car. But for F1 in Schools, it's literally a miniature F1 car that's launched across like 20 meters. So there's not too much of aerodynamics concept that goes into it as well. But one interesting fact about F1 in Schools is actually they have to use the actual, you know, software that they use to design the cars, like CAD and all that jazz. Yeah.
And I guess it's like, so if you were to sum up the experience, how would you sum up the whole experience? Probably in a sentence or two?
Yeah, I think it would be very educational. And I think in terms of like building the awareness for STEM, it's a great platform for kids to really, you know, dig deep and really experience what it's like to run a Formula One team on that level, which is like before going to uni, you're still in college, you're still in high school. So yeah. And then speaking about teams, actually, I think let's just go straight into the episode. Let's start with team orders, right? I mean, there was one of the most iconic talking terms that came during the leading up to the Baku Grand Prix, right? So during the Italian Grand Prix, the phrase papaya rules was echoed throughout the team radio when Lando and Oscar was battling each other for the victory, and it sparked a lot of criticism within the paddock, right? With F1 pundit Will Buxton saying that the team should prioritize the championship instead of having two number one drivers escorted by Zak Brown. And this comes amidst Ferrari recent upgrades, which have propelled them back into the championship fight, whilst the Red Bull appears to have dropped off a cliff in recent races, especially after the summer break, and Mercedes having won two out of the three races before the summer break. So yeah, John, I think my first question is like, is McLaren still practicing a midfield mindset despite them having a championship winning car that's capable of winning not only the constructors, but if they play their cards right, they could even win the drivers' championship as well?
Okay, so I think a lot of McLaren's current ethos is very team focused. It's all for one, one for all. I guess that's also the culture that Zak Brown and the management team at McLaren have instilled over the past couple of seasons, which as a midfield team, as you pointed out, that works fine. That works great. Everybody is working in the same direction. But they lack the killer edge that Red Bull Red Bull, Mercedes have, where to say that need to maximize the championship odds no matter what, which you can see, I think, in the recent races, especially in like Silverstone, where there were operational errors when McLaren were leading 1 and 2. And I think the team orders before all of this would be the most infamous at the Hungarian Grand Prix, where a strategy undercut had left Lando ahead of Oscar, even though that Oscar was leading comfortably. So, and then there was a whole lot of back and forth with Oscar and his engineer, as well as I think Andrea Stella had to step in at some points. So there was a bit of a culture clash also, like in terms of that and fighting for the championship. But on the other side, McLaren are leading the Constructors' Championship now. So it has worked out in some way. It's like for the first time in a decade, McLaren are the Constructors' leaders. For the drivers, it's still a bit tight in court to see that whether Lando can overtake Max, still pretty unlikely, especially with Ferrari in the mix and Mercedes being touch and go at points. So yeah, I think they do have a bit of a midfield mindset, but if they are aiming for the Constructors, it's probably still in their hands. For the drivers, it's probably too far out of reach. Yeah, but I mean, on that point, considering that before the Baku Grand Prix, Oscar was said they would be supporting Lando in his quest to try and catch Max. So Nathan, I would like to ask you, if you were in Oscar's shoes, would you help your teammate to secure the driver's championship, or would you just prioritize your own race?
Yeah, I think it's very right to point out the interview that he did in the lead up to the Baku Grand Prix, right? So obviously, I mean, Oscar is a nice guy, right? He's from Australia, so he's nice. Like they got the Australian spirit. So obviously, you know, he's aware.
It comes from his manager, Mark Webber, as well.
Yeah, exactly, right. So, you know, he's Australian, right? You look at Honey Badger, he's such a lovable personality. So you're a racing driver, right? Obviously, you want to do your very best to win races, to drive the fastest, right? So obviously, you could see it was a little bit uncomfortable for him when like the interviewers was pressing, it's like, oh, will you support Lando in the championship? Because mathematically speaking, he's a little bit further than you. But at the same time, the tricky thing with this situation is that there is no clear number one and number two driver. They are both good. Like on a good day, Lando can win. And on a good day, as we've seen in Baku, Oscar can win as well. You can even argue that Oscar to a certain degree now is progressing a lot faster than Lando in the same car. It's not like, let's say, Vettel and Leclerc, or Lewis and Nico, or Lewis and Bottas, or even Max and Checo, right? There was a clear number one, number two. It's not the same over here as well. So in that sense, it's a little bit tricky. So it's, I guess from a team's kind of perspective, it's very hard to balance, because they you mentioned earlier, right? They really prioritize that whole team mentality, right? Well, one for all for one kind of thing. But I mean, if I was in Oscar's shoes, if I have a chance to win, I don't think I would know, like, you know, race all the way to the last lap and just let my teammate go for the win. Yeah, I mean, you're a racing driver at the end of the day. Your job is just to drive the car to the fastest. So what's the point of, like, you know, supporting your teammate even though he's mathematically further, but you can win the race? So yeah, that's that. But on that note, right, how realistic is it for team orders when challenging for a championship? Obviously, you watch F1 a lot longer than me, so yeah.
I mean, just to correct the point that you mentioned earlier would be Vettel and Leclerc, even though Vettel was number one at the start of the season, and like in 2019, I think Leclerc kind of asserted himself, and then at the end of the season, it was kind of even at that point, which is why they had like the whole Russia thing where Leclerc was supposed to give Vettel the pole, but then Vettel refused to give it back. And Nico and Lewis actually had the reverse problem. Mercedes let them fight all the way, and then there were some crashes there, which Mercedes still hangs on the wall at Brackley. But how realistic is it? I guess it could be a thing. Like McLaren had dealt with two number one-ish drivers in the past when Button and Hamilton were in the team. When Button came into the team in 2010, he was the reigning world champion. And for the most part, it was quite even. They didn't really have to make any team orders. I think the only team orders they had to make back then was when they were fighting wheel to wheel. McLaren just basically said, don't be stupid, bring the cars home. So probably it's just that in precautionary terms. And I think a better example and what I would suggest for teams to kind of adopt would be, ironically, Ferrari. not something that people would say, let's follow Ferrari team orders, but...
So rare, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But in this case, it's a pretty unique situation was that when Raikkonen and Massa were teammates around across 2007 and 2008. What Ferrari did back then, because Raikkonen and Massa were very close throughout most of the season, would be to decide a certain point in the season, which, if I'm not mistaken, for them, it was Monza. And then once that race has finished, would be whoever is ahead in the championship at that point would get priority for the rest of the season, which I think is fair. It's like, okay, you've gotten about probably 2/3, maybe 70% of the season done. Whoever is ahead at that point, you are the number one for the rest of the season.
But Lando has this like very infamous record of like bottling the start. So that's just that. Like, I mean, if he can actually convert from pole to win, I don't think that's an issue. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that's just that.
Yep. I mean, speaking of starts, and going into the new era, one team is shaping up to take a fresh new start and to propel themselves up the grid. Aston Martin has made another stateless signing. So all the news and anticipation, Adrian Newey has finally agreed terms with a team, and it has been announced that he'll be joining Aston Martin in 2025. So even us here in Race Recap, we've written an article where would Adrian Newey end up? Would he be just retiring? Would he go to Maranello? But now he is confirmed that he'll be joining Aston Martin as the managing technical partner, which in addition to his roles, he'll be given some shares in the team. So having worked with Aston Martin in designing the Valkyrie, this new deal would see Adrian Newey earn a reported £30 million a year alongside the aforementioned shares in the team. And interestingly enough, look at the amount of technical people that they have in the team. They have already recent hires such as Andy Calvo, the ex-Mercedes high-performance powertrains man, Bob Bell, formerly of Renault/Alpine, Enrico Cardini, formerly of Ferrari, and also Adrian Newey's own deputy. What was his name again? I think because he's the technical...
Dan Fellows, was it?
Dan Fellows, exactly. Yeah. Yep, Dan Fellows as the technical director. And all of this is the emerging super team within Aston Martin, as well as the existing upgraded facilities at their Silverstone headquarters. And I think like they've recently opened new facilities there, and they're going to continue and upgrade their facilities. So it's quite a prospect that Lawrence Stroll has brought to the team with all the technical capabilities as well as the infrastructure upgrades. So Nathan, I would like to ask, with Newey's hiring, would this be the final piece of the puzzle to make Aston Martin F1 World Champions?
F1 World Champions, eh? That's a huge goal. But I mean, say what you want about Lawrence, Papa Stroll has the money and money talks in Formula 1. So, dang, I mean, the fact that he actually got Newey to complete that final piece, like, it's literally, as you mentioned, a super team, right? I mean, it still boils down to the drivers, to be honest. Like, you can have a great team, but you have, like, Lance driving the car, so yeah, there's that. I mean, if they had two, like, Fernando is great, right? Like, he's out driving the Aston Martin at the moment, but Lance, I mean, you look back at his career in Formula One so far, he has been in the spot for like so long. So I would say, from a technical point of view, excluding the drivers, it is a complete team, right? You have basically the best of the best joining Aston Martin, which hopefully should put them back into championship contentions come the new regulation cycle with Honda joining as well. But yeah, I think on top of that, I think Newey also has ties with Aston Martin's supercar project, which is the Valkyrie as well. So could this move also be part of Aston Martin's preparation to prepare for their WEC campaign as well?
I think it's possible because like Aston Martin will be due to entering the hypercar class in WEC in 2025. And if I'm not mistaken, they're also planning on entering the IMSA equivalent for North America. And with Newey's existing ties with Aston Martin, having designed the Valkyrie and then helping that enter the Endurance Championship, that would be interesting. And Fernando Alonso himself has won Le Mans twice and is a World Endurance Champion himself. So, yeah, definitely possible. And I think that's probably a smart move there if they're trying to conquer the Endurance side of the championship. I mean, with such drivers there, personally, it would make sense as well, like, you know, if they can hire a better driver in the second seat, we could just move Lance over to the Endurance Championship. Why not give it a shot?
Max Verstappen. The whole thing about it.
I mean, everybody wants to hire Max Verstappen, but then I think Toto is extra keen for Max Verstappen. There is like the moment any vacancy appears in Brackley.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I think it's possible. But I guess the question would be, is this the best move for Newey, or would you want Newey to try something else?
I think I saw somewhere from Formula One, Newey has always been a guy that loves a challenge, right? He went to Red Bull when they were just starting out, and you know, he built a championship winning team up to now. So it's not uncommon for Newey to go to another team who looks like they have the potential and try to flip things around. Obviously, I mean, you're a Ferrari fan, so obviously we would have loved to see what happens, you know, if Newey pair up with Hamilton, you know, the greatest designer with the greatest driver. It's a what-if story that's been confirmed by Newey as well, but I guess we got like him and Fernando Alonso, so him working with his arch rival, so that's interesting. I mean, to be honest, as cliche as it sounds, as long as he's happy. So yeah, but I'm happy to see that Newey is still in Formula One and he hasn't like hung out his drawing board yet. So yeah.
I mean, just to add one more point to that would be, I guess Newey has looked at history and looked at Ferrari, no matter how many times Ferrari has courted him, the amount of offer that they get. Ferrari would be more strict on their technical personnel, so as opposed to in the announcement, Lawrence said, you know, to Newey is that it's Adrian's technical team. He can pick and choose who he wants to work with. I don't think Ferrari would give him that freedom. And just to delve back into Formula One history a bit, previously they had an English designer, John Barnard, working remotely in England while the rest of the team were based at Maranello. At that time, even though Enzo Ferrari himself approved of that hire and then specifically approved for John Barnard to work in England, Ferrari being what it is, they had a splinter faction working on a separate car while John Barnard was designing his own car. Both two cars for the same season. So that's just how Ferrari rolls. So probably it's for the best that Adrian Newey probably didn't go for Ferrari, even though as much as I would have wanted and loved to see that happen.
Yep. Speaking about division within teams as well, let's move our eye to Red Bull, right? Obviously, they are a big talking point. Ever since the summer break, they haven't been able to continue on their momentum. And with like, you know, big names such as Newey and recently the sporting director Jonathan Weefley leaving, there's been a bunch of changes with the Milton Keynes team. So Max Verstappen, Formula One engineer, GP, has been promoted to head of racing, where he will now continue to oversee the race engineering operations within Red Bull, but will also take over the responsibility for the race, heritage and car build teams, reporting to technical director Pierre Walsh. Stephen Knowles, the current senior strategy engineer, will become the acting head of sporting for Red Bull and will report the GP. His focus now will be on the regulatory and sporting matters, making him the team's primary link with the FIA. And also senior engineer Richard Wolverson has been promoted to the head of race team operations, where he will oversee the team's daily activities. Gerard O'Reilly, head of race team support, and logistics and Phil Turner, race team factory operations manager, have also taken on new roles. So yeah, I mean, it's clear that there's a lot of changes that's going on with Red Bull, especially like with their big talents leaving. So I guess the question is, how important is it for a team to balance between internal and external hires, right? So obviously this has to do with, you take a look at McLaren, right? I think they recently hired a bunch of like talents externally as well. So I totally understand why teams don't really want to look externally when they can promote from within. It's good for morale as well. It's good for stability. It's good for continuity. But yeah, I mean, yeah, John, that's my question to you. How important is it for a Formula One team to maintain the balance between sourcing for internal talents and external talents?
I mean, just like any organization, it's important to have succession planning for within so that the existing ideas can be continued. But it's also important to have fresh new ideas from external hires in order to reintegrate the team and to make sure that all parts have new ideas brought in and they don't become stale. I guess an example of this would be previously, I think like during the Ferrari Dream Team stage, I think when their chief designer Rory Byrne retired, he passed the baton over to his then deputy Aldo Costa in order to design some of the later Ferraris, which, yeah, they won championships as well, and then Aldo Costa became very successful at Mercedes. External hires like that, teams, they move here and there a lot, which I think one story I could give would be for importance of an external hire would be during the Braun GP year, there was the infamous double diffuser. it's been rumored that one of the initial discovery was made by Super Aguri mechanic or some of the technical staff there. Super Aguri at that time was the Honda B team, but they got shut down in mid-2008. Thus, and then three separate teams managed to find the same innovation. Williams, Toyota, and Honda, which became Brawn GP. It's been rumored, and this is of course just haven't been confirmed, but some of the technical personnel that from the field, from the demise Super Aguri, moved these teams and brought those ideas to them. So they gave the impetus for the fresh innovation there. So if you make the right hires, you could get the right ideas and the right innovations coming. But I mean, well, Nathan, as you're a McLaren fan, when Andrea Seidel moved over to the Audi, they elevated Andrea Stella, you know, to become team principal. And they've made some external hires, but in their matrix system, they infamously let, who was it again? David Sanchez, I think. Yeah. David Sanchez go, I think, like only after a short while. Now he's at LP. So I guess it always depends, and probably shouldn't hire too much, but you should hire some as well.
I guess the final point to note is, like, if you're talking about race operations, it's always good to have continuity, because obviously the mechanics are very familiar with the way people work. In terms of technical teams, it's always like a clash of ideas, right? I think in Sanjay's case, he was brought onto a project where he had an expectations and the expectations just weren't met.
I guess one more thing to add would be GP's new role seems to be a bit like a deputy team principal to Christian Horner specifically, because it seems like he, head of racing, continuing to oversee all the race engineering operations and also taking over responsibility for the race and car build teams, it seems like he'll be the final step before it goes to Honda them directly.
Yeah, you could be right as well. And also because GP has been there for quite a while already. So yeah, I guess Ridley Rowe was more or less the same thing. I only know Ridley as the guy who was very famous for making Red Bull being super quick in the pit stops.
I mean, there was that. And then, like, if I'm not wrong, he was the one that lobbied for Michael Masi to, like, start the race one lap early. So... best legacy, but interestingly enough. And then, I mean, like, he could be that, but also it's like he's reporting to technical director Pierre Wacher, so I'm not sure what the structure is, but I guess otherwise our thinking would be what Mercedes had for Jerome D'Ambrosio before he moved over to Ferrari, but at this point I'm not sure. But yeah, the rest of the team could be interesting, but then every team needs to change, right? So yeah, speaking of change, we have more news on, like, a new driver confirmation, especially for the Silver Arrows. After long speculation, it's finally been announced that Andrea Kimi Antonelli would partner George Russell at Mercedes in 2025, taking Lewis Hamilton's seat. It was on the eve of the Italian Grand Prix, and a day after making his FP1 debut with the Silver Arrows, Andrea Kimi Antonelli was finally announced that he would take the second Mercedes seat alongside new team leader George Russell. The Italian, who's currently 6th in the F2 standings at the time of recording, but joined the Mercedes factory team to replace the outgoing Lewis Hamilton, who famously was announced to be joining Ferrari in 2025. So it means for the first time in Mercedes history, both on the driver lineup would be ex-Mercedes Junior team, with Kimi Antonelli being a current Mercedes Junior, and George Russell now has joined the Mercedes Junior team in 2017. It's now in his fourth season, going to be his fourth season with the Silver Arrows. And before moving on to questions, I would like to note also, like, a statistical point would be, this would be the Mercedes factory team's first time in Formula One operating without any world champion in their driver lineup, because they've had Juan Manuel Fangio, Michael Schumacher, or Lewis Hamilton racing for them at all times until 2025. So who knows? It's quite a shot in the dark for them. But yeah. Nathan, I'll pose a question to you. Do you think it's a risky move for Mercedes to give the seat to Kimi Antonelli, considering that his F2 campaign isn't exactly going as smooth as it could be?
Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned, right, Kimi didn't have the smoothest campaign in F2. Maybe it's his fault, maybe it's the team, the car, whatever. But it's definitely a risk, because he I mean, the only time we saw him in proper F1 machinery, he crashed in 1.5 laps. Not the best way to make your good first impression to the team that you will be joining, especially since they announced that he's going to join the team on the same weekend that he crashed their car. So there's that. And he's pretty young also, right? I mean, Toto touts him as the next Max Verstappen. I mean, it's more like he wants Kimi to be the next Max Verstappen, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, his rise to the junior ranks is definitely impressive, right? From F4 to F3. I mean, no, not F4 to F3. I think all the way from F4, he skipped F3, went into F2. So, yeah, I think personally, I would have preferred if they put, like, let's say, Carlos in the Mercedes for at least 1 or 2 years and let Antonelli develop in the Williams before, you know, bumping him up. But I guess they didn't want to repeat the mistake with Russell where they put him in Williams for 3 years before promoting him to Mercedes. So, yeah, definitely. And it's because of, like, he's young, he has talent, but he just lacks the experience, right? And he's only signed on, like, a 1-year deal. So it's kind of like there's a lot of pressure for him to perform right out of the gate against, yeah, in a new car, against, like, a relatively experienced teammate as well. So, yeah, I'm a little bit uncertain on that. But also, is Antonelli's promotion to F1 showcasing the success of the Mercedes junior team program, John?
I mean, it's hard to say at this point until either Russell or Antonelli wins the championship or something. Does up their win through the junior ranks, Russell, you can see because he was the reigning F2 champion with when he got the promotion to his Williams race. Antonelli at this point is quite an unknown quantity. He's not a bona fide clear championship material or that is immediately primed for promotion to F1, which in the same way as Scott Piastri was, Charles Leclerc was, and in some ways, which regular listeners of this podcast would know that some F2 champions have not gotten the right opportunity because due to the limited seats, drivers such as Thierry Bourchet or Felipe Drogovic, who are currently reserve drivers, or had to find seats elsewhere. It's just that his ties to Mercedes would have gotten him the seat, not so much his links and his performances there, which in a way it could be seen of Oli Bearman as well, because with his ties with Ferrari, because for all it's worth, Mick Schumacher won the F2 championship before he got his seat. Not as well, but as we come to later, sometimes things just don't work out. So I guess the final point to this would be, for this driver lineup, do you think Russell has what it takes to be the calm and wise team leader to a rookie teammate? Or will he just go Fernando Alonso style or a young Yuki, like how what it was with Hamilton?
And that's an interesting question, right? I mean, Russell hasn't, at least to me, give me enough confidence to vote for him and say, like, if this is just a hypothetical, right? If Mercedes can challenge for the championship next season, which they won't, but if, let's just say, if that happens, right, I don't think I can trust Russell to be the leader and actually lead the charge in the championship. Because you look at the times where he could have won a race. I mean, like, he could have won Singapore. I mean, he was in a good position to fight for the win in Singapore last year and he crashed out. The wins and podiums he got this year was a bit, I mean, Austria, he inherited the win. Baku, he inherited the podium. The one time in Belgium, he pulled off a great one stop. He got disqualified. So yeah, there's just a little bit of like ages that needs to be smoothened out for Russell. But I mean, if it's just a 1 year kind of thing and they know they're not going to challenge for the championship, I'm sure like he's a decent guy. Like he can show Kimi the ropes, you know, just for him to ease in. But also, I don't think Russell has built a team around him, right? Unlike like Albon, where it's very clear Williams is built around him and he owns the team, right? I don't think I see that in Russell as well. But what do you think, John? Do you think Russell can be that wise, collected team leader? Because I just don't see that with him in Mercedes.
I'm not so... Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I haven't seen everything that for Russell to say. I'm working for the team and then I'm willing to do what it takes in order to sacrifice my position, in order to help my teammate. And then in order for us as a team to do better, I guess the only time that happened previously was like one or two moments when he was partnered with Latifi and he was like, sacrifice my work in order to get Latifi into a better position. But it just seems like he was always in conflict with Hamilton at this point. So I'm not sure he has or is willing to take a back seat here. So I'm not sure. In that sense, I'm not sure would it be in his best interest or would he be keen to support his teammate or even to an extent of would it be? I don't know, even to the extent of what Magnussen and Hulkenberg do for each other, or at least when Magnussen is holding the rest of the field up for Hulkenberg to score a couple of points. But yeah, so I'm not sure. It's probably a similar case with Ocon and Bammon at Haas, where it's an unproven quantity, a fresh, young rookie teammate. We're not sure. And Russell is supposed to be an established driver at this point, but we don't see like that many commanding performances, probably except the Belgian Grand Prix, which was incredible, but it didn't work out in the end. Yeah, I was actually kind of expecting Mercedes probably just to get like Bottas on a 1 year contract and then like put Antonelli on with a year's contract with Williams, but then I guess James Vowles isn't that keen to be as close to Mercedes. He wants to do his own thing, but I guess that's how it works out. Yep. So I mean, that's the main news that we've had for the month. And then now we're moving on to the bite-sized updates. For those new to the podcast, bite-sized updates would just be smaller pieces of news from the wider Formula One and motorsport community, where we just cover them with any bits of news and just cover them briefly. So the first bit of news would be our favorite topic to cover on RaceBot, Alpine. Yep, once again, Alpine employees in France went on a strike to protest the shuttering of the engine division during practice for the Italian Grand Prix.
Alpine, yep.
They have gone on a strike due to Renault's plan to axe F1 engine program as chairman Luca Di Meo decides to make it's been noted, nothing has been confirmed yet, but to make a switch to a customer Mercedes supply from 2026. The Alpine Racing Works Council, who represents workers at the Viry facility, believes abandoning the French engine will be a betrayal to the original Alpine vision and a disgraceful abandonment of the team's legacy and 50 years of high-tech history and expertise, as reported by the Race. In addition, with the lack of a French Grand Prix and the Alpine team base actually being in Enstone in Oxfordshire, the Alpine Racing Works Council warned that this could result in a permanent cessation of F1 activities in France, who holds a long history in sport. I mean, at this point, what else is new with Alpine, right?
Yeah, do we even need to say anything at this point? It's just like Alpine being Alpine, the French being the French. It's just, yeah.
There is never a dull day if LMP. There will always be drama.
That is true. That is true as well.
Very spicy team, but yes. I'm like, my goodness, what is going on?
Very engaging, very engaging. But yeah, I mean, it's just them being like French, being French, and like, we need our culture, you know, we're like, you abandoning, literally the phrase that's being quoted, right? It's like abandonment to the betrayal to the original Alpine vision. Wow. So there's that, yeah.
It's like, it's so dramatic, but then I'm like, at this point, there's nothing not dramatic about this team.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess there's just only two outcomes, right? It's either they really switch to Mercedes, or I can see them like either getting sold out, which we already discussed in the previous episode. But yeah, there's that. On the other hand, we have a team, surprisingly, that have enjoyed quite a fair bit of success in recent years. Ferrari, right? So Ferrari enjoys more success across the pond during the Italian Grand Prix weekend. So the same day Charles Leclerc won for Ferrari in Monza, Robert Kubica, who is an ex-F1 driver, Robert Schwartzman, who is part of the Ferrari Academy and recently participated in an FP1 outing for Sauber, and Yifei He, who was part of the Renault Sports Academy in 2019, shared the winning AF course run Ferrari 499P Le Mans hypercar in the Austin World Endurance Championship round. The Le Mans winning outfit of Antonio Fuoco, Miguel Malina, and Nicolas Nelson took third at COTA, making it the double podium for Ferrari cars. So yeah, what a rare day where actually Ferrari are successful. Like, it's so rare. But yeah, what are your thoughts, John? You're a Tifosi.
I mean, at this point, there are some races where if Ferrari just makes it to the end of lap one with both cars still running, it's probably considered a success. So it's nice to see that the endurance team has been doing well. They've won Le Mans in two consecutive years, and it's nice to see that Kubica finally achieved his goal of winning a race for Ferrari. So that's nice to see. And yeah, nice to see that Fuoco, Molina, Newson has gotten another podium. And then as well as that, they've just recently won Le Mans, so Ferrari have added another race win. I think at this point, we've been saying for a couple of years, you know, maybe Ferrari should try going for the IndyCar route. I don't think they're going to win the F1 championship anytime soon, so why not with the Indy 500, right?
Yeah.
So, speaking of Ferrari drivers and and their young drivers and what they've been up to.
Mm.
And ex-Ferrari young drivers now has also finally secured some success following his junior program. Mick Schumacher has finally scored a WEC podium at Fuji. So despite starting the weekend with the worst car, Mick Schumacher and the Alpine WEC team managed to take a well-deserved third place at the 6 hours of Fuji. So yeah, apparently Alpine can run the race. Who knew? Schumacher, alongside his teammates Lapierre and Vexivier, managed to bounce back from qualifying 15 to make the final step on the podium after passing the number 12 Jota Porsche 963 of Norman Nato with 10 minutes to go. This marks Mick Schumacher's first visit to the podium since his title-winning F2 campaign in 2020. And it's quite nice to see. I think everybody agreed that Haas at that time was not in a good place. It's nice to see that he's getting some success elsewhere. And I guess, surprise, surprise, Alpine can run a race somewhere.
Indeed, indeed. I guess the Schumacher name just has a bit of pressure when you're in Formula 1. Obviously, Mick was at Haas. And maybe it's the car, maybe it's the team. But you could feel that when he got into Formula 1, there was a lot of pressure for him to emulate what his father did, right? Michael Schumacher, the legendary 7 world champion. It's also, I guess, a good confidence boost for Mick. Like, yes, he can actually be on the podium. And yes, Alpine can actually make race cars that go on podiums as well in another series. So yeah, that's that. I hope it gives him a confidence boost, and it's just a little bit like extra credit that he can use. Because obviously he's a Mercedes reserve driver as well, and the driver market is always changing. So yeah, kudos to Mick, especially for starting the weekend on what was dubbed the worst car. So yeah, without further ado, let's continue on that Ferrari trend as another ex-Ferrari F1 junior and former Alfa Romeo test and development driver signs for Prema's Racing first ever IndyCar. Signs as Prema Racing first ever IndyCar driver ahead of the 2025 season. So Prema Racing has appeared in multiple F1 FIA World Championships, including F2, F3 and F1 Academy, and will be making their official debut in IndyCar in 2025. So the driver in question is actually Callum Ilyard. So Callum Ilyard raced for the team in 2017 when he was 18 years old, and he scored 6 wins and 11 podiums in European F3, which was then the top FIA-backed F3 level championship. Ilyard finished second to Mick Schumacher in the 2020 F2 Championship, but was unable to make the step up to Formula 1, having served as Ferrari's reserve driver in 2021 and was recalled by Alfa Romeo to serve as their reserve in the 2022 Miami Grand Prix. So since then, he's actually been in IndyCar for 2 seasons with Juncos Hollinger Racing, featuring a P12 finish in the Indy 500 and 2 top 5 finishes. He has also deputized the injured David Malukas for Arrow McLaren in 2024. So this year, he's actually in the World Endurance Championship Hypercar category with Hertz Team Jota, where he won the 2024 6 Hours of Spa with his teammate. So yeah, it's nice to see that, you know, Ilyard is still up and running. Glad that it's always nice to call yourself as the first driver of any team, much less like Prema, and it's also nice to see Prema joining IndyCar as well. So yeah, John, what are your thoughts?
Yep, I fully agree that it's nice to see one of the junior categories, large teams to make the jump over to IndyCar, and nice to see that Callum Ilyard has also been given a second chance with a decent shot with a team that he's comfortable with. And also, team officials have stated their appreciation and working with Callum Ilyard in the past. It's nice to see he has that. And also, yeah, giving him another chance in open wheel categories. He's also already had success with Hertz Team Jota in the WEC. Who knows? At this point, it's possible that he might try for an Indy 500 win as well as the 24 Hours of Le Mans, which is possible. Porsche is one still the most successful constructor in Le Mans. And I mean, also probably best for him that he got away from McLaren, because as I've been telling Nathan this a few times, is that whilst McLaren in Formula 1 have their success and struggles, McLaren in IndyCar is definitely something else. How many drivers have they replaced this season already with David Balogas? And then they had Callum Ilyard before they getting Timo Porsche in. Then they sacked Timo Porsche, and then now they got another driver again.
Dang. Yeah.
At this point, like, what in the world are they doing?
Yep.
And they're not even winning the championship there. So who knows?
Never have I heard a team constantly swapping out their drivers. Okay, maybe I've heard of a team constantly swapping out
Red Bull.
Their team principals, that's Alpine. That's a different...
Yeah, but I mean like Red Bull as well as I think. But Toro Rosso and Yikab used to change the drivers a bit as well.
Oh, yes. There was the cynical driver swap, second Red Bull seat kind of thing.
Yeah.
I guess there's that. Once again, Thank you so much for listening to the episode. Obviously, we were recording this on the eve of the Singaporean Grand Prix as well. So we are personally excited as that, because that's literally the closest race we can call our home race. And yeah, so don't forget to follow us on Spotify and drop us a review on what you thought about the episode. So if you want more updates on the newsletter, you can follow us on LinkedIn. And also if you want more updates from our page as well, follow us on LinkedIn and type the word race recap to get like race previews, post-race findings, as well as, you know, any updates on what we're doing. So yeah, once again, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Jonathan.
And stay safe, and I'll see you in the next episode.